From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Director of Partnerships here. It's your Friday edition, which means I am sitting in for Tony Perkins, and I'm glad to be with you today. Lots to talk about, as always. TonyPerkins.com is the podcast website. As a reminder, go there for resources and information on today's guests and initiatives. Well, House Democrats on the Ways and Means Committee said on Thursday that over 60 alleged hate groups, mostly socially conservative organizations, anti-illegal immigration entities, and religious groups, should be stripped of their tax-exempt status. And in just a minute, I'll talk with Republican Congressman Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania, who serves on that House Ways and Means Committee, where Dems convened a meeting entitled How the Tax Code Subsidizes Hate. In my second segment, the College Board, which administers the Scholastic Aptitude Test, known as the SAT, to you juniors and seniors at high schools across the country, has decided to momentarily backtrack on their adversity score, which took into account that race and socioeconomic level of the students who take the SAT should be weighted appropriately. Well, I'll talk with Bill Marshall about a recent column he wrote, Further Erosion of American Meritocracy, at townhall.com. At the bottom of the hour, we like good news, particularly on Fridays. On Monday, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that a pair of Christian calligraphers, artists, cannot be forced by a city ordinance to make wedding invitations for homosexual wedding ceremonies. I'll talk with John Scruggs, Alliance Defending Freedom Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Conscience, about this great victory. And at 42 past the hour, on Monday, September 9th, Jared Wilson, a 30-year-old associate pastor and father at Riverside's Harvest Christian Fellowship, died by suicide. Wilson, who was always open about his struggles with depression, also led the church's mental health ministry. And I will talk with Dr. Steve Gersevich, president of Key Ministry, about his column entitled A Psychiatrist's Thoughts on Pastors and Suicide. Join the conversation on Twitter. Follow Tony at T. Perkins, or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. And again, TonyPerkins.com is the webcast or the podcast site. And we've got their information as well on the webcast we held on a book called Why Meadow Died. You'll want to check it out. Well, some interesting happenings on the Hill this week. House Dems on the Ways and Means Committee said on Thursday that over 60 alleged hate groups, mostly socially conservative and religious groups, should be stripped of their tax-exempt status. And some of the bigger organizations on the list include the American Family Association, which opposes the homosexual agenda, the Anti-Illegal Immigration Organization, Federation for American Immigration Reform, the conservative think tank, Center for Security Policy, and yours truly's group, the Family Research Council, because we affirm a biblical, Christian, orthodox understanding of marriage and sexuality. These groups were designated as hate groups by none other than the discredited Southern Poverty Law Center, whose founder was fired this year for sexual harassment. And there was, after that, remember, a mass exodus of top management after it came to light that this was an organization replete with internal charges of sexual harassment and racism. And yet, this is the organization telling you, America, what is a hate group and what isn't. So in the House Ways and Means Committee hearing yesterday, entitled How the Tax Code Subsidizes Hate, Democratic Congresswoman Judy Chu of California said this in her comments to tax code attorney Marcus Owens. Let's listen.
Mr. Owens, the Southern Poverty Law Center has a list of over 60 hate groups that have tax-exempt status.
That's right. Tax-exempt status for groups, including ours. So joining me now is Republican Congressman Mike Kelly, who represents the 16th District of Pennsylvania and serves on the House Ways and Means Committee. Congressman Kelly, welcome to Washington Watch.
No, Sarah, thank you so much for having me on. I surely appreciate this.
Well, so the hearing yesterday was a real doozy. The Dems entitled it How the Tax Code Subsidizes Hate, right? So they are saying that the government is subsidizing groups that millions of Americans would find abhorrent. But do you think that the average American and what we've begun to refer to after the 2016 election as flyover country, those of us right in the heart and soul of America, would be fooled by this ridiculous rhetoric?
No, you know, and I think that from people of faith, if you look at this, there's over 1.5 million groups right now that have tax exempt status. Okay, this is called a 501c3. It's in the tax code. And if you start to ask me, I told people, if I came out of St. Paul's on Sunday after Mass and I talked to some of my co-parishioners, say, what do you think about the issue with the 501c3 and how we're subsidizing hate groups? They'd look at me and say, excuse me, I didn't get that from Father's homily today. Where did you get that? Here's what's going on. And we know this. This is the game right now that is being played. The far left, the people that are really the true haters in this country, they will look for any differences between us that they can use to divide us. Mm. Think about who Ms. Chu was referring to when she said the Southern Poverty Law Center has come up with these 60, including this group right here, Family Research Council, say, but they're fostering hate. They're promoting hate through a tax code. In fact, these people don't have to pay taxes. And in a way, that's what we're doing. We are allowing this to happen. We are, in fact, subsidizing it. It is so far away from the norm. This, and as you know, and I don't know if people were able to watch that that hearing on TV and keep a track with it, but there were three panelists that they brought in, three people that suffered terrible losses. One was a young man that was at the Pulse in Florida. Another was a man, Mr. Blinkley, whose daughter was killed at a yoga class by a deranged person who decided to come in and do this. Another, Ms. Casa, she was from, I think, El Paso, when she was talking about what happened in her community. But none of them were speaking from the standpoint of what the code says and what the Constitution says, because the real assault here is on the First Amendment rights. You and I would agree with this. Listen, there's nothing that I would say that I would defend some of these comments that are made by these hate groups, but I will defend their right to say it.
Absolutely.
You don't have to listen to it. You can turn it off. You can walk away. You can say, I would never, ever go to anything like this or belong to any group like this. That's our option as citizens. But to say to them, you can't say this, you can't do this, and then to say, wait a minute, who are going to be the speech police? Who are we going to put in charge to pick and choose who should be there? Are we going to use somebody like Lois Lerner? Oh, my gosh, what did we find in the last administration? How they use this as a political weapon.
Right.
And so we have to be so careful the way we walk down that path. And Professor Golock, who was there, or Bolock, who was there, I asked him, I said, so, Professor, tell me, how narrow is this speech issue? He said, it is so very narrow. Unless it incites violence, it's not something that we can say we may not agree with it, or we may not want to listen to it, but we do say they have the right to say that. In the United States of America, you have the right to say it. I abhor all these things that are happening, whether it's racist comments or bigots or anything, but really, who comes under more hate speech than those of us from faith-based communities, of what we have to put up with every day, and saying that somehow we are part of that hate group because of what we firmly believe? I just think this has gotten so far off the rails. I'm just hoping that our people, and the people that are listening to you and I right now, understand that in order to stop this, you have to stand up. You have to be active. You have to talk to your sons, your daughters, your friends, your neighbors, and say these elections are absolutely critical. Do not allow power to go into the hands of this group of people that are out there, and this far-left group that is ruling the Democrat Party right now will stop at nothing to keep you from presenting your views. They'll listen to almost everything else, but they'll try to constantly attack us. So I find it so objectionable.
I am so glad that you said what you said about elections, because every chance we have to encourage people to go out and elect people who represent their values, who will stand for constitutional fundamental freedoms as they were intended by the founders, who will not impinge upon our fundamental freedoms, chief of which is religious liberty. And as you know, we are an organization that subscribes to traditional biblical orthodoxy and marriage and sexuality. This harkens back for me and for many of us here who were discussing this early on this morning to the Obergefell decision. And I'm reminded of what Justice Alito said when he said that the decision in the case will be, and this is a quote, used to vilify Americans who are unwilling to assent to the new orthodoxy. In the course of its opinion, the majority compares traditional marriage laws to laws that denied equal treatment for African Americans and women. The implications of this analogy will be exploited by those who are determined to stamp out every vestige of dissent, end quote. So really, Alito called it right down the sticks, as we say in football. This is somebody who saw the writing on the wall, and lo and behold, we are seeing exactly the same transcription here in the United States Congress of what Alito and the other dissenting justices were concerned about. These are not individuals who are taxpaying Americans who are subsidizing hate also, because Representative Kelly, you understand this, it's almost a misunderstanding of the tax code. American taxpayers are not subsidizing these organizations. These are individuals who make a choice to donate to these organizations. And what we simply do is we keep that donation money, donations that come from individuals who already support our belief system. So it's almost as though in their Twitter feed, the Ways and Means Dems didn't really understand how this was supposed to work anyway.
Well, you know what? I will say this. Anything that we see happening now to the confirming of our Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh, how we watch what they put him through, they understand exactly what they're doing. They understand that they can occupy people's thoughts for a few moments, but if they can, in that few moments, plant a seed that then becomes something different and something worse, they've accomplished what they want to accomplish. If you were to sit and listen to them, and a lot, you know, I get along with a lot of our friends on the other side of the aisle, and I think they abhor what's going on with their own party right now. But this outright demand for power, to be in power, to be able to do these things, to be able to police us in a way that we never thought we would be policed. I say, listen, if you want to go to this, the judiciary can make a decision as to what it is that's going on right now. But, Sarah, I think you and I will agree. And one of the things I suggested in my opening statement, because I thought this was so great when James Madison, the Federalist 51 paper, said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. This is about having control over ourselves.
Oh, Representative Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania, what an excellent take on a very complicated notion and one that we need to be watching very closely. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony on the Friday edition. Coming up next, the College Board, which administers the SAT to juniors and seniors, has decided to walk back its adversity score, which took race and economic level into account. I'll talk with Bill Marshall, senior investigator at Judicial Watch, about his column entitled Further Erosion of American Meritocracy at Town Hall. Coming up next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday
paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. TonyPerkins.com. Why don't you visit it today? Find out some more information and links to a webcast we had earlier this week that you're going to want to check out if you care about education. Well, my next guest is a senior investigator at Judicial Watch, and he breaks compelling stories. But the piece I want to talk about today is a piece that he wrote at Town Hall called Further Erosion of American Meritocracy. And in it, he talks about a principal feature of the country in which we live. Bill, I am so glad to have you here. Bill Marshall, an intelligence analyst, senior investigator, and a contributing columnist to many different publications. Bill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks very much, Sarah. It's great to be on.
So I have an article here in front of me that I really, as a parent, as someone who is passionate about education, particularly cares about, because you not only address the specific issue of this adversity score for people who take the SATs, but you talk about, at sort of a 30,000-foot perspective, how we view the ability to achieve the American dream. And you really sort of dissect the difference between how conservatives and liberals view that dream. Can you explain a little bit about how we as conservatives would probably view it?
Yeah, well, you know, as I say in the piece, traditionally, you know, we conservatives take the view that the individual responsibility, strong work ethic, and keeping the government out of the way of the citizen, way the citizen's quest for success sort of lies at the heart of the American dream, and that's in, you know, strong sort of contradistinction to what the Democrats' view is, which is that everyone's a victim, of course, except of course for you know, straight white males. Everyone else falls into some kind of victim category, and there's this sort of pantheon of victim tiers, you know, and depending on who you are, what demographic you fall in, whether you're, you know, male, female, black, white, Hispanic, gay, straight, whatever, you somehow fit into this, into you know, some level of victimology, and they don't believe in merit. I don't think. I think this is the you know, this is the fundamental one of the fundamental divides between the right and the left in this country. And I think it was best reflected maybe in Barack Obama's infamous comment in July 2012, where he says, you know, he's at a campaign rally, and he says, "You didn't build that," talking to successful people. And that is precisely the opposite of what I believe this country was founded on, and demonstrated, illustrated very well. Obama's mindset and that of the left generally in this country, that people who are very successful don't earn it through hard work and merit, but through some sort of exploitation of you know, vulnerable people.
So you talk then specifically about this college adversity score, and this is important for individuals who are parents out there, and every one of you will have to deal with an SAT test if your child wants to get into college. And the College Board had originally proposed a adversity score, which took into a formula 15 different factors relating to socioeconomic background, poverty, crime rates, median household income, advanced placement course availability. So no longer just a cut and dry numerical score on math and English, as it was when we went to school, but something that would have weighed in one direction or the other, a sort of affirmative action score of types. But they have walked that back, and this was recently, as of about 2.5-3 weeks ago. Why do you think the College Board walked back this adversity score? I am surprised, because this looks particularly like a perfect educational initiative and sort of comports with what you said, that this is victimization over meritocracy.
Well, I think that parents across the country recognize this for what it is, and it's an attempt to inject subjective criteria into sort of a calculus to benefit individuals that the College Board management, if you will, or seniority viewed as somehow disadvantaged unfairly. And that's actually reflected in a comment that the chief executive of the College Board, a guy named David Coleman, made to the Wall Street Journal when they were investigating this, because they broke this story originally back in May. He said to them, "We can't sit on our hands and ignore the disparities of wealth reflected in the SAT." Now, that's a clear, you know, statement of what his goal is. He's trying to put his his thumb on the scale. And this, of course, is exactly what the purpose of the SAT is. Is to give college admissions officers across the country a snapshot of where a student stands in terms of his proficiency in a discrete number of subject areas compared to the entire population of kids of that age taking the test on the same day. You need an apples to apples comparison, right?
Yes.
And of course, the SAT isn't necessarily a perfect predictor of future success. I mean, my kids, I've got three kids, are all grown, and my wife and I are blessed that they've been, you know, they've had successful academic careers, and now are off in their professional endeavors. But so we've been through this, you know, and they were accepted into some great colleges, and they were turned down by others, and that's called life. We have to deal with adversity, and to the extent that we try to benefit one demographic group over another, you cannot possibly be fair in this process. And you know, I think the SAT, I think the College Board's sole mission, personally, should be to provide sort of this common metric by which students' abilities can be compared across the board. And they shouldn't be getting themselves involved in sort of political decisions, by factoring in qualities that really cannot be fairly measured.
Bill Marshall, one of my favorite guests. He is senior investigator at Judicial Watch. Go to judicialwatch.org for more information on what they're doing currently, and go to Town Hall to find Bill Marshall's columns. You're listening to Washington Watch. Well, coming up next, we're going to celebrate. We've got good news on the religious liberty front. The Arizona Supreme Court ruled that two Christian artists cannot be forced by a city ordinance to make wedding invitations for homosexual marriages. I'll talk with ADF attorney John Scruggs coming up next on Washington Watch.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, and I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Well, I love good news, and I'm sure you do too. On Monday, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that a pair of Christian artists cannot be forced by a city ordinance to make wedding invitations for gay weddings. In Brush and Nib v. City of Phoenix, Arizona's highest court ruled that Joanna Duca and Brianna Koski, owners of the studio Brush and Nib, cannot be compelled by a local anti-discrimination ordinance to provide their services to homosexual weddings. Does this sound familiar? We have been down this path before. Joining me now with his analysis is John Scruggs, Alliance Defending Freedom Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Conscience Initiatives. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
No, thanks so much for having me on.
So once again, God has used ADF in a very big way. Congratulations on your victory.
No, thanks so much. We're obviously extremely excited, and probably more importantly, the clients are thrilled. Anytime when you get a great win with some great language declaring that the freedom of speech and freedom of religion are significant and can't be really crushed by government action, it's a great win.
Yes, it is. Now, in 2013, as I understand it, Phoenix added a new ordinance titled Discrimination in Public Accommodations, which banned discrimination in places of public accommodation against any person because of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, or disability. Now, in your view, explain for our listeners how this was not applicable to the two women who ran the studio.
Yeah, and this is a vital distinction. So Joanna and Brianna, the two artists here, they create art for all people, for all different classes of people, but they just don't create art celebrating all messages. So, you know, for example, they don't create artwork promoting racism or demeaning people of other faiths or even demeaning people in the LGBT community, no matter who asks them. And the same is true for the topic of same-sex marriage. We don't create any artwork celebrating same-sex marriage because of their religious beliefs. But Phoenix interpreted its law to say that is discrimination and illegal, and the law imposes fines of up to 6 months in jail and $2,500 for fines per day that the clients here, Joanna and Brianna, wouldn't create the artwork that they objected to. And that includes, you know, writing words and painting paintings celebrating same-sex wedding ceremonies.
And that's really sort of a forced speech analysis, isn't it? It's sort of a forced speech. We are compelling you to say the thing that you disagree with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing more speechy than writing words, handwriting words, saying, come celebrate the marriage of John and Jim, for example, or God bless this marriage would be another example. There's nothing more, really attacking the conscience to force someone to write something and to paint something that that violates their core convictions. And that's exactly what Phoenix was doing. But again, it's important to stress that there's plenty of artwork that Joanna and Brianna will create for those in the LGBT community, but they just can't convey messages for anyone, certain messages for anyone. So they challenged the law and eventually went up to the Arizona Supreme Court, and the Arizona Supreme Court spoke loudly and clearly in saying, look, disagreement with a message is not discrimination against a person, that we live in a pluralistic society. We've got to learn to disagree over certain topics, but that doesn't mean the government can come in and crush you if you don't say the right thing.
Well, and in keeping with sort of some of the thematic discussions about today, this really is sort of a bully pulpit as far as the government is concerned, treating it the same as discrimination when, in fact, it is just disagreement, really takes that power out of the hands of the government to use it as a weapon. Now, I understand that the high court's ruling was limited. Can you explain how that's the case?
Well, it was it didn't address every conceivable topic, right? And that's how courts usually work. They take the facts and the parties before them. So they protected the ruling in some respects is limited to just Joanna and Brianna. But that's the holding. The principles announced in the case will apply to protect speakers all across Arizona and really the country, photographers, filmmakers, other writers. And that's the most important part. Every case only applies to the parties, but it's the principles announced that are so important. And when the Arizona Supreme Court says the government has no power to compel speakers to voice a message they disagree with, that gives us all protection.
Indeed, it does. And I'm assuming that based on what we know has happened at the Supreme Court with another ADF case, Masterpiece Cake Shop, we won't be seeing an appeal from the city of Phoenix. Is that your guess?
Well, we are very confident that no matter what happens, whether it was obviously before the Arizona Supreme Court, if it goes elsewhere, that we would win this case because the facts are so clear. But one thing you do see, as you noted about the Masterpiece decision, you see a growing trend by judges recognizing the protection of free speech and free exercise of religion.
What an encouragement to all of us on this Friday afternoon that there is some good judicial sense left in the world. John Scruggs, ADF Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Conscience Initiatives, has been my guest. And you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, on Monday, September 9th, Jared Wilson, a 30-year-old associate pastor at Harvest Christian Fellowship, died by suicide. Wilson was open about his struggles with depression and led the church's mental health ministry. So who ministers to the ministers? I'll talk with psychiatrist Dr. Steve Gersevich coming up next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christian's call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins today. TonyPerkins.com is our website. I encourage you to visit it. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, on Monday, September 9th, Jared Wilson, a 30-year-old associate pastor at Riverside's Harvest Christian Fellowship, died by suicide. Wilson, who was open about his struggles with depression, also led the church's mental health ministry. And hours before his own death, he had actually officiated a funeral for a woman who herself had died by suicide. He shared the news with Twitter followers on Monday at 11 a.m., writing, quote, "Officiating a funeral for a Jesus-loving woman who took her own life today. Your prayers are greatly appreciated for the family," end quote. Well, after the funeral and shortly before taking his own death, the pastor reminded his followers that mental health is not something that can just be cured, no matter how strong your faith is. The father of two wrote, quote, "Loving Jesus doesn't always cure suicidal thoughts. Loving Jesus doesn't always cure depression. Loving Jesus doesn't always cure PTSD. Loving Jesus doesn't always cure anxiety. But that doesn't mean Jesus doesn't offer us companionship and comfort. He always does that," end quote. By 11:45 that same night, Jared had committed suicide. Joining me now with his analysis is Dr. Steve Grisevich, president of Key Ministry, a psychiatrist and a blogger who wrote a piece entitled "A Psychiatrist's Thoughts on Pastors and Suicide." His ministry, Key Ministry, is dedicated toward ministering to those in the church dealing with the challenges of mental health and disability, and it is a ministry that has benefited and blessed in extreme measure my own family. Dr. Grisevich, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, Sarah, thanks for having me, but I wish it were under different circumstances.
Oh, I do too. But let me tell you, your piece was absolutely wonderful. It was timely. It was thoughtful. And you speak from a particular level of expertise and knowledge as a psychiatrist. And you write in this piece that most of what you had seen about this particular instance had been written about by other pastors. And that has its own unique perspective. But your perspective as a psychiatrist is especially helpful because you understand the particular mechanisms, the working and the mystery of the mind. But I find it ironic that even though Jared and his wife Julie had founded Anthem of Hope, which was a ministry specifically dedicated to those battling brokenness, depression, anxiety, self-harm, and suicide, it wasn't enough to save him from taking his own life. What can we possibly make of that?
Well, Sarah, these are serious illnesses. And, you know, in the same way that if someone has cancer, is referred to an oncologist, not everybody survives cancer. The same is true with mental illness. Again, we know that, like, suicide is one of the top 10 causes of death in the United States. And in people in Jared's age bracket, he was 30 years old, it's the second leading cause of death. And so that there are situations, and I've investigated a little online, and it's not clear exactly what the nature of any kind of mental health treatment it was that Jared was getting. But, you know, clearly, you know, for him, whatever help he got didn't work. Now, that doesn't mean that other people shouldn't seek out help in the same way that you wouldn't refuse to go to a doctor if you had cancer or if you had heart disease. It's just that we're not yet at the point that we can save everybody, and that's part of living in a broken world.
So a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with Greg Laurie, who is the senior pastor of Harvest Christian Fellowship in California, where Jared Wilson was on the staff. And 2 days after Jared's suicide, Pastor Laurie made these comments that I want us to listen to.
People think that we as pastors and spiritual leaders are somehow above the pain and struggles of everyday life. We're supposed to be the one that have all the answers, but we don't. At the end of the day, we're people just like you. We're all in the same boat, so to speak. We need to reach out to God for his help and strength each and every day. Jared had put his faith in Christ, and that is why I believe right now he is in the presence of the Lord in heaven. One dark moment in a Christian's life cannot undo what Christ did for us on the cross. Romans 8:38 says, Paul speaking, I'm convinced that neither death nor life nor angels or demons or fears for today or worries for tomorrow or even the powers of hell can separate us from the love of God. We do not go to heaven because of what we have done. We go to heaven because of what he did.
So let's talk about that, because there are still some Christians, you and I have talked about this off air at different formats, who still believe that suicide is the unforgivable sin because it is self-murder. So what would you say to people who are listening today who are wrestling with that question?
Well, I believe that the only unforgivable sin is to not accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you think about different leaders in the church, and as I was listening to, like, Greg's comments, 2 Corinthians 1 comes to mind, where you look at the Apostle Paul talking about despairing of life itself. You think about Elijah under the shade tree, you know, and the moment that he had when he was running for his life and, you know, feeling hopeless and depressed. And so some of the godliest, passionate leaders described in Scripture wrestled with this themselves. And again, I don't see any buts, you know, when you take a look at the promises in Scripture where, you know, for example, whosoever believeth in him shall have life everlasting. There's no unless you die by your own hand there.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things as a psychiatrist, though, that sometimes I struggle with a little bit around this is that I do have Christian kids who come into my office who sometimes are wrestling with these kinds of issues. And oftentimes it's the fear of what might happen in the afterlife that keeps them from acting on some of those thoughts. So I don't necessarily dissuade them of that when that's something that I think might be helping to keep them safe. But on the other hand, from a theological standpoint and from the teaching I've had, the understanding of Scripture, as Greg talked about in his piece, we have no reason to believe that folks who wrestle with this, you know, as with any other medical condition that, you know, contributes to illness and death, no reason to believe that if they accepted Jesus, that they're not with him in heaven.
I love what you said about some of the giants of the faith, because this is something I've often thought about on my own. You've got Job, you've got Elijah, you've got David hiding in the cave from Saul, writing out the Psalms, talking about how devastated his spirit is. I'm encouraged by the fact that really the Bible is replete with people who are so like us. I have to laugh because obviously God understands the human spirit and believed that the individuals that we would learn from, read about, are those who are like us, who struggle with the same things that we do. But I want to specifically talk about the trend, the very unsettling trend about how this is a pattern of suicides by young pastors specifically. So do you believe that now, because we are in a very sort of media-centric world, that even in the ministry environment, these individuals, these young pastors face more scrutiny and more intense pressure, and that could be a contributing factor?
Oh, absolutely. Now, in general, my practice is pretty much limited to children and teenagers. But on occasion, because of ministry stuff and connections I've had, I've been involved with seeing adults. And I think about a pastor who I saw for a long time here in Northeast Ohio, a very prominent church. And he would only come to see me at 7 o'clock on Saturday mornings. My office was a considerable distance from where his church was, and he wanted to be gone and out of the building before anybody else in any other office would arrive.
Wow.
You know, there's situations I've had where I've been seeing children of pastors where we would make special arrangements. They would come in on Sunday evening, and they would park their car in the back of the building so that nobody driving by the office would happen to notice that they might be there visiting me when nothing else is open in the building. Mm. And so there is, unfortunately, an enormous stigma about this that still remains in the church. And a couple of things that I touched on in the blog post are that one of the challenges for pastors is that, first off, they may not know where to go to get help when they need help. And that there was a Lifeway survey that showed that when they interviewed family members in the church of people with mental illness, fewer than 30% said that their church had a current list of mental health professionals that they could refer people from the congregation to who were in need. Second, one of the issues is that for many of our pastors, they don't have either the money or the health insurance benefits to be able to access care. I came across a study by Lifeway where nearly half of Southern Baptist pastors at churches between 100 and 250 in weekly attendance get no health insurance benefits from their congregation. And 25% of pastors in large churches, 250 and above, get no health insurance benefits. And many of the Christian health share ministries, in fact, all of them that I know of, refuse to cover any mental health treatment. So that, you know, that these guys are oftentimes in a situation where they're struggling. They don't have a lot of money. I mean, obviously, because pastors are not, you know, paid in the same way that other important people in society are. And, you know, from the standpoint of someone who served on a couple of church boards as an elder, I think it's immoral to ask these guys to serve in the way that they do without providing them and their families with the means of being able to access really good care when they need it.
Oh, I would so agree with that. I think we need to lift up these individuals, not remove them from ministry, but make sure in their service, in their responsiveness to the Lord's calling on their lives, that they are also equipped to lead and serve. So I would ask what you think pastors ought to do, particularly in dealing with mental health. And I love that you mentioned what you did about a particular pastor who sort of saw you on the sly. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a former pastor of mine before we moved. It was a small country church. He was a wonderful, godly man. And he came to me and he said, I can't talk to anyone about my depression. And I actually referred him to keyministry.org, your ministry. But I realized exactly how isolating it is to be pouring into other people and yet to feel that your own tank is empty. And on top of it, have to deal with the stigma that still surrounds mental illness, even within the church body, where there should be no stigma. So what do you recommend pastors do to receive help?
Well, first, I think that you have an obligation when you're in this kind of a position of responsibility where you're serving other people to take care of yourself as best you can so that you are better equipped to care for other people. It's like when you're riding on the airplane and you have a child with you. You put on your oxygen mask first and then you take care of them. You're not going to be able to shepherd and pastor people if your mind isn't right. Mm-hmm. Secondly, one of the things I think the churches need to do, and something that I've seen a number of guys struggle with, is that obviously that there is a tremendous expenditure of, you know, mental energy and emotion when you're pastoring and shepherding folks in a church. And that, like doctors, and we have the highest rate of suicide of any profession, we tend to give and give and give, and we're not taught or we're oftentimes not trained to do anything else where we can step away for a while, you know, be able to get out of some of the day-to-day pressure of having to care for people and focus on getting well. And so that one of the things I think church boards can do and the pastors can ask for is that maybe they need to have a little bit of time away to be able to take a sabbatical when the burdens of ministry are getting to the point that it's exacerbating whatever issues that they have with mental health.
I love the idea of sort of standing in the gap for these pastors. So for those of us who are sitting in the pew, whether or not we understand that these pastors are struggling with their own individual issues, we've got about a minute left. What would you encourage the parishioners, the churchgoers like me, to do to help these individuals?
One of the things that I hear from pastors in the work we do with our ministry is that one of the challenges that they face is that all they hear oftentimes from the people that they're shepherding are criticisms. People don't send you emails when they like your sermon on Sunday or when they agree with some particular policy or whatever the music happens to be in church. I think that we all need to recognize that pastors are giving all they can to try to care for and shepherd us. And as someone in a congregation or in a church, I think that our obligation is to encourage and come alongside and let them know how much we appreciate what they're doing and how important it is for each of us and for our families.
Dr. Steve Grisevich, keyministry.org. I encourage you to visit. You've been listening to Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. We'll talk to you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.